Totalitarianism loves these tools.
So, how do we start?
Hi, this is Aga and Łukasz, and this is Catching the Next Wave podcast, where we discuss the future of design.
And much more.
Narratives, experiences, and imagination. What is the common denominator here? It's our guest, Professor David Basuk. David is a professor of transmedia immersive performance, directing, and gameplay and performance at the College of Purchase at the State University of New York. What kind of school is this? It is one that combines the rigor of liberal arts and the sciences and super world-class conservatory programs in the visual and performing arts. It was recently named one of the best national public liberal arts colleges in the US. So if I were to be a student again, that would be the place I would like to study. Next to being a teacher, David is a theatrical director and a playwright. He has been a creative director of the Magical Mystery Tree, a live stage show located in the amusement park Wonderland in China. Recently, David directed a play, Earthquakes in London, performed in December in New York. I saw the pictures, amazing. And he's also starting another initiative, Experience Design Life, which includes workshops and training in the service of rethinking life. David, so awesome to have you here with us today.
Pleasure to be with you today.
So since I haven't met you before, and I've heard a little bit from Aga about you as a person, but not as what you do, I need unpacking.
Okay.
Right? So liberal arts, sciences, performance, all in one. How does it work?
Well, colleges and universities create boundaries and borders between the study of life and the study of play. Sometimes you have the opportunity as a professor to begin to cross those boundaries and really find that it is actually the same practice to engage an actor as it is to engage a storyteller, as it is to engage a person in the humanities and a person in new media and a person in the visual arts. When they work together in order to do world building, do project design, and actually it's the complementary nature of the collaboration and the diversity of the collaborations that make the university actually begin to be a place of creation and real thought and real engagement.
Okay, so it's not about training one person to be a master in all these aspects. It's about bringing these people together so they work together and create something.
You know, in the theater, a theater director, which is where I both begin and continue to see myself, a director in the theater works with actors, prop designers, scenic designers, musicians, projection designers, audience development people, community development. All of these things are, by their nature, cross-disciplinary and collaborative. And so, as we enter an age of interactivity in a post-internet world, we begin to just see that the possibilities of connecting and collaborating expand, not just by in a theater, but beyond a theater. Therefore, interaction with audiences no longer in seats. So really not audiences by definition, really. They are now players, or they are engaged as users of an app. They are beginning to not have a set design, but they may have a location setting. That is also, now you need a different tool, you need a different team of collaborators to expand the project into the different affordances of the different platforms.
There is one word that I would like you to decipher for us,
yes.
Transmedia. Please tell us what it is.
So transmedia is a fairly new word, and so it begins to capture the possibility and probability that you would distribute the content across different and multiple platforms. So not only in the internet, but maybe in a augmented reality experience, also perhaps in a piece of writing, perhaps also in a found object that's part of a live action game. So the project expands across trends with different mediums having different affordances. You wouldn't do the same thing in an app that you would do on a live stage play. Why would you? The medium or the platform affords you different creative collaboration. I mean, if you're doing a play in a traditional theater as opposed to into an arena stage, as opposed to into an immersive stage, although you may have similar content, the content mutates to the affordances and the collaboration of the space. Similarly, if that space is online, if that space is something that needs to be unlocked inside of a room, all of those pieces. So Transmedia Speaks, developing people who are thinking not only expanding outward from their main idea across different platforms, but then it speaks to the most exciting part of transmedia, which is that it begins to recognize that the audience are not merely receivers, but they're also potentially collaborators. And once that happens, one needs to really think through engagement, whether it's in games, whether it's in dramatic structure is designed, and the way in which it evolves so that you're not just looking at narratives, but you're looking at emergent narratives. You're not just looking at one path, but you're potentially having a forked or branched path, just like in games, where your own ability and your own interests determine what part of the content you get to explore.
If I would try to summarize it in a word, that would be making it as lifelike experiences as possible.
But is it really about lifelike, or is it using imagination to give you experiences that engage different means and different senses, but they don't necessarily have to replicate life?
No, but there is something in what you're saying, in that we are used to very limited, I mean, I say used to, but there are plenty of examples of the pre-internet age where these existed, where you see that a story or a narrative or a belief system permeated everyday life in all kinds of places. My students, they will often ask, where did this start? Well, I said, the place that I always think about where it started is the Catholic Church, because you have both things that you can do at home in terms of practice, things that you can do in terms of reading, things you can do together, songs. You even have video projection design in the cathedrals where you had images that were played out across the congregation with light coming through the stained glass windows. To the degree that the stories became depicted and there were different ways you could access it depending on your interests and your skills. Now, to say that one would take a story, a fictional world, and be as ambitious in permeating everyday life, that's where I think transmedia performance takes a new role, because it's almost impossible for any one person to do it all. So you're almost by nature, by the scope of what's being attempted, one is having to learn how to work collaboratively and work in teams with different expertises, but also about the spreading out of content. When I'm looking at transmedia projects, the key thing is not just what is the scope of the platforms being engaged, but also what is the time frame for rolling out the different projects, and thinking through not in terms of 2 or 3 weeks or a month or a season, but over a course of years. Because a project like this can't really take hold and gather its audience and have its audience play the pivotal role that it needs to play unless time is factored into the design.
Everything that you talk about connects to the concept of immersion, which is, in a way, a new way of thinking about what performance can be. But there are, of course, different levels of immersion.
Right.
You've got the interactive immersion. You can have the passive immersion where you're just sitting in the middle of the theater
right.
And the action is going on around you. But there's more. There can be immersion that you mentioned, which is co-created. Mm-hmm. But also you mentioned something that's called environmental immersion. Could you unpack it a little for us?
Sure. I think most of what I read and hear about and witness are spaces that have been devised and designed to put the audience on their feet, moving inside of a fictional world. Many times these projects do not require anything but our ability to move through them and be struck in awe. Many of them are very much like the passive immersion of sitting in a theater. The only difference is you may not see everything as you move through the environmental immersive project. Whereas if you're sitting in the theater, if it's been well staged, you see everything that you are meant to see. There is no bad seat in a theater that has been designed for you to see it. Whereas the environmental experience sacrifices clarity for emotional and physical connection. You can have the little hairs go up on the back of your neck when you're watching a play or watching a film. We all have done this, and this is a form of immersion as well. Passive immersion is the book, the play, the piece of journalism. We are immersed in the stories in our life, but we sit like with a distance from it enough so that we can think about what we're being put in the midst of. Whereas in environmental immersion, some of our judgmental questions can be turned off. And it is both potentially wonderful and potentially dangerous. The subject that I'm always concerned about is once the audience loses all ability to judge, all ability to censor, question, you find yourself potentially challenging the emotional, mental, spiritual health of the audience. So people who place audiences in that kind of situation need to be careful that they're not merely taking away the agency and the judgment of the audience in order to sort of be a more powerful storyteller.
How should we see the audience in all of this?
Well, when the audience is, I sometimes call them APs or audience players, but when the audience player is engaged to think, to judge, to create, to figure out what's going on, but also work with other audience members, now you're beginning to shape and design a communal and a societal entity that is the audience. That's, I think, potentially very interesting. I think that the role of storytellers always had a role in shaping society and shaping imagination, allowing people to project their darkest thoughts, project their most altruistic thoughts. And if you look at the designs of the traditional classic plots, whether they're redemption plots or testing plots or degeneration plots, all of these plots are designed with fables that are transformative, at least to the perspective. I don't think that the audience has changed its hunger for wanting to be told a powerful story, just mm-hmm. because now that story can be told in an environmental setting. I think it's an opportunity to expand upon the setting of stories for an audience that's much more interested in interactivity. Every artist throughout history has used the tools that best speak to audiences' appetites and interests. And I think in an era of the internet and smartphones and intercontinental connectedness, knowing things immediately and instantly, it's been an adjustment for people as individuals and societies as a whole. We're watching this play out real time every day in the news. I mean, the nature of news has completely changed. So how can a storyteller in that setting be sure that they are accomplishing what they wanted to accomplish in the transformation of ideas and connections to reality if they only use tools that ask them to put away their cell phones, suspend all judgment, sit in this seat? We have to think about not just new forms for the sake of new forms to be able to continue to be a rich resource for audiences as we have been in centuries past.
Again, the other end of the spectrum. So I'm now paid for a big bank to do something that they call digital transformation. And they think it's about transforming their business, but it is not. It's about switching the mindset of pretty much everyone in that bank. So this is where part of what you said today, where it resonated. So if we treat this as a transformative experience, this is really what I'm trying to do, including like a course and exercises and talking to them, you know, working daily with them. I mean, this is the other end of the spectrum because everything is geared towards the transformation itself. This is the ultimate goal.
Whose transformation, though? The banks or the audience? There's the creator, the person who initiates. That's the bank. But then there's the audience or the customers, and that's the people who bank there or invest there.
No, these are people who work at the bank.
Oh, well, even more so. Because if you engage the people who work at the bank in a transformation, it will affect the customer.
Yeah.
Because you can't transform the life of the customer without transforming the life of the employee. And companies that try to do that, it never works. College is a perfect example. Colleges often treat their faculty and their staff as not at the heart of what's going on. And then let's say even that that was a good idea because they were worried about how much they paid them or if they had hired them on the wrong contract, any of those things. Well, who do they meet? The graduations, it was about what happened between the teacher and the student, but also between the person in financial aid or in the registrar's office and the student. It's also what happens between the custodian and the student. The entire community of employees, what they feel about the place, what they feel about the student, is reflected in the student's takeaway, what they feel was valuable. I mean, this is where the Joe Pyne stuff is so beautiful and why he uses theater, I think, as his metaphor. Or he actually says, "What? It's not my metaphor, it's what it is."
So, yeah.
I love that. But then I hear Joe Pyne say that and I think, in theaters, we forgot it or we never knew it. Or he thinks we think it, but we don't actually think it. That's what we should be thinking. So, you know, we have to bring what he's discovered in theater to theater.
I was just borrowing that from you.
They're wonderful tools, and the metaphor is great. I mean, Joe Pyne is completely correct about this. What I often encounter, though, is colleges, theaters. We have a thing in the United States. We have movie theaters, which people go to less and less and less because they have these big televisions, right? So the movie theater, you would think, would make a better experience for the people who did show up. But instead, it's like they're punishing us for being too few an audience. It's like if I start my class with saying, "Boy, where is everybody? We have like some absences today. Why are people absent?" That's dumb. I'm talking to the people who showed up.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Why am I talking to the people who actually were there, prepared, but the people who weren't? It's a mistake that a lot of people make all throughout different industries. People are focused on what's not happening. And while it is happening, it's like the, you know, love the one you're with. It's like you gotta.
Oh, yeah. When I'm thinking what you're saying, I'm thinking that it might mean that the theaters have to be rebuilt. Because naturally, the setup is passive audience on one side and actors on the stage playing.
I'm very delighted, I want to say, that all forms of communication have persisted, from cave drawings to cartoons, from radio to podcasts to audio installations. They do not interfere with each other. In fact, they make each other richer. In the theater community, it often is a worry when another theater shows up in a town that only had one theater before, that the original theater will lose audience. But in fact, they gain audience because now there's more people who want to try a play or won't judge the all theater by that one play that they didn't like, right? Mm. And so the amount of different types of platforms, from the theaters where it's traditional and you sit and you hear the play, to the play where you experience the play. I've been actually occasionally really disappointed in immersive theater and have found traditional theater still working very well. But it doesn't mean that I believe that audiences of the future will continue to persist in accepting only one type of performance to go to. I mean, when I started teaching immersive theater and interactive design and gameplay, the number of students who filled the classes enthusiastically was tremendous, because the subject matter is where they already have active imagination.
Still wrapping my head around this transmedia experience, mm-hmm. and how it would interplay with the forms of play or entertainment that we have now. Mm-hmm. But that sounds like it might be a little bit bigger disruption, because you mentioned that it's collaborative, mm-hmm. and it should last longer if it has to have an impact.
Well, one of the key elements of transmedia storytelling is serialization, so that pieces occur in a sequence. It may be a sequence that comes out of order, where you have a second season, which is actually the prequel to the first season, and you may have an episode which is far into the future. The timeline of the narrative can extend in a very interesting way, but also the ways that your life is prompted or interrupted, opportunities come to you of the narrative, maybe in different forms. There could be phone calls, there could be connections made randomly in a game that you walk into a reality and then you realize that's actually part of the game. Some of the things that we saw with Nonchalance doing years ago have permeated the culture in terms of opportunities for storytellers to build an audience. The reason it takes longer, or should take longer, is that we have depended in the past on mass marketing. And we have depended on a system which does not exist powerfully at all, if it exists at all. For some audience members, it still works. I had a theater company in Philadelphia for 10 years. During those 10 years, we were completely dependent on newspaper ads, newspaper reviews, radio ads, couldn't afford the television ads, and really wasn't our audience particularly anyway. It wasn't until we started to recognize that we needed to find our audience and go there. I had an idea of doing a play based on Kafka's short stories that I called Kafka's Smile. And the board of directors of the theater said, you know, we're never going to find the audience for this play. I mean, they may exist in Philadelphia, but will they all come on these 3 weeks in April? How will we find them? And I said, all right, I will direct one less show in the season, and I will spend a year creating lots of small symposiums, performances, lectures, Kafka and the law, Kafka and the Jews, Kafka and science fiction, a dance piece that we had connected to Kafka. We had Kafka cartoons, and the city was suddenly in the midst of what seemed like a Kafka celebration. We created so many, many, multi, mini events. Well, by the time the show opened, we were sold out. We extended it. The review came late, but it didn't matter. It didn't matter. And we barely advertised the play. And this was pre-internet. So when the internet comes along and I begin to understand transmedia, I was like, that's what we did in Philadelphia back in the 90s, but we didn't have the tool set. And it took me a year to fill a theater in Philadelphia with a play that nobody thought they wanted. So I made the case for a year, and I found that audience. But then if you do that, you can't do four plays a year and be a theater company. You have to do a project over a period of a year. So it wasn't just Philadelphia, but if it was the country or if it was a larger audience, it can take 2-3 years. And projects that don't have the ambition to gather the community around the idea or the project are not thinking well about what they're making and why they're making it.
You said that the theaters, they should think of how they want to shift the paradigm of thinking mm-hmm. of their audience. And maybe this is a wrong perception, but for years I saw art as something focused inwards. So like you as an artist have an artistic expression that you want to share mm-hmm. with your audience. And if the audience is interested in it, fine. If it's not interested in it, fine. With immersive theater, but with everything that you're talking about, this relationship with the audience changes. Mm-hmm. So it comes closer to design, where it becomes this exercise in understanding who the people are in order to be able to influence them one way or the other. Am I right with this thinking?
It's really interesting what you're saying. I think you are right. And I do think it really does go to the question of when we are making and when we are building and when we are creating narratives, if intention isn't at the core of what we're doing, then we're providing our own self-analysis and our own potential healing by projecting what's inside of us outside of us. And that certainly is a part of the process of all subjective creation. At the moment that the subjective creation transfers into a magic circle where now people are welcomed into it, if the intention is not to communicate, transform, mediate, educate an audience, then it was never meant to be shared. Now the question is, if you do want to share it, even if you're not entirely clear about what you want people to get from it, because that may emerge once people encounter the piece, I don't think artists necessarily need to be able to anticipate every possibility of an audience's connection. In fact, some of the most exciting experiences I've had of making theater and making performance of different kinds is the surprise to myself of what people took away from what I made. That was the gift that actually made the next project more meaningful. But at the point I am right now, I feel like every time I gather to lead a company of actors or lead a project that begins to get everybody, you know, we say in the theater, everyone on the same page, or everybody, we're all doing the same play. What that is, if you're a leader of an artistic group of collaborators, is you have a sense of what is broken in the world that you want to add support to. There is something broken in people. There's some broken society. There's something that people need time to meditate on, and you're going to give them that space in your project to find forgiveness, to find courage, to find a deeper, more profound way to engage with the people that they love and that they like, and where they want to sort of build what they consider a nation or a home or a society or a planet. So very ambitious, but if you don't have an ambition to build civilization as an artist, I think you end up as a person trying to destroy civilization. And I'm not for that. So I feel like it's certainly possible for an artist to come from very personal, subjective sources towards objective purposes. And it's that process that goes from the profound, deep connections one may make with the material that you're working with or your people you're working with to a notion of building that community. If building the community for a project is labeled marketing. There's a very pejorative way that people in the theater in the United States say, we say, talk about getting butts in seats. And that's not it. That is not it. And we are so far from being able to really think about the connection that we're making with our projects if we're not really thinking about who is coming and what do they want? What did they get? What was the transaction? Were they served? Were they transformed? Do they have better ideas for us about the next time? The Kafka play, to come back to that one more time, we had some of the most extraordinary post-play discussions, because the piece was very personal from me, but ultimately, because that audience had been truly gathered with intent, they were also, when they arrived, a brilliant source for the theater company as well.
This is a very interesting concept, arriving with intent. Whenever we go to a theater, I am not sure that I'm ever arriving with intent. Mm-hmm. I come because of a recommendation or because we just wanted to be entertained. Okay, entertainment is also an intent, obviously. Mm-hmm. But there's so much richer space to design for intent before you arrive. Is this being done?
Yeah. I just saw the most extraordinary performance. It came from London, performed in New York City at St. Anne's Warehouse. It was a play called The Jungle. It was a play built out of the oral history of the migrant camp in Calais that was since destroyed by the French government. You arrived at the play with, you know, all of your fears that it would just be a lecture, your hopes that it would be something that left you with some hope in a society like ours in the United States right now, which we are feeling the real importance of building hope for what might follow what we're living through right now. But the performance was much more than that. It had been designed as a story. It had been designed as an environmental experience. It had been designed with compassion, with intelligence, with both nonfiction and fiction. It got to you so passionately with its humanity. By the end of the show, my throat was completely closed, as I get when I'm very emotional. I was crying what we call ugly crying, and I got more motivated to get involved in what's going on politically as a result of it. So I arrived going to a play that one of my students had commended me. She says, you must see this. And I was like, okay. I wasn't feeling very well that week. And I was like, but I am getting my ticket and I am going. And it was extraordinary. The intention was completely realized and powerful. The direction, the acting, the setting, the design, the documentary support after you saw the show, what they gave you to feed your thoughtfulness afterwards of what you would do with it, was terrific. And there are lots of projects that go up around the world that are deeply filled with intent. You know, they have to be good too. It's not enough to have good intention. You have to have good craft, good skill, marvelous talent on stage, marvelous design, marvelous choices to be made by the director, music, the physical life, all of those things. And you need a community, a building effort by the theater that gathers that audience. It happens, even in traditional forms.
What I was thinking is, like, can you build an intent in your audience before they enter the theater?
Yes. And that's where transmedia comes in. Because if what you are doing when you begin to make your audience aware of the project is you bring them content, not notices that it's coming, but actually content. You bring them a short story. You bring them a beautifully designed painting. You bring them something that happens in the midst of commuting in a train station. You bring them different elements that are, each of them, artworks, but in those different platforms. It used to be, if you saw a beautifully designed poster, you thought, well, potentially this might be a very well done play. The poster was your sign that there was some quality in what might be on stage. And sometimes that was true. With transmedia, you have more than just a poster. I was just working with a student who's building a project that is an immersive, basically it's a LARP in the shape of a theater project. And he's been working at building an audience for about a year prior to arriving in the audience. And so one of the people working with him has a poster, and he shows me the poster. And I said, that's good. You know, what week is this poster? And he was like, well, no, this is the poster. I was like, no. You need to have at least one poster a week or once every 2 weeks. And this is one poster. What about this? What about that? you're building a momentum of interest and potentially intent so that when people arrive, they are primed to see what we want to show you. And so if marketing isn't a blast of news, which nobody's interested in, if instead it's the priming ultimately from attention to intention, but attention is what it's about, and focusing that attention from the beginning, from the rumor to the project, to the afterglow.
If it's such a strong tool, this transformation, do you have the same thoughts in your head sometimes as the people who build the atomic bomb? It's a great tool that can be used for a number of purposes. Does this come into the consideration as well?
So you mean that it can be used for the good and for the evil?
Yeah. You're not talking about the project on the inside, but you're talking about the mechanism of building an audience.
What I understand is the purpose of this whole project, including building audience, maybe not so much building, but priming the audience,
right,
is for them, I understand. So when they arrive in the end, suppose that it culminates in one place, like as a play, if it's interactive or not, that we leave for a moment, that is meant for them to be influenced more by this final performance, to potentially have this transformative effect on them, that they arrive slightly different people, that they enter the whole process.
Right.
And that, of course, could be used as a tool for very different purposes.
I totally agree. This is something that always concerns me. I mean, that's essentially why I'm always interested in using the tools of kindness, generosity, thought as opposed to emotion, the right balance of those things, because I think that totalitarianism loves these tools and has many ways demonstrated these tools throughout history in the earlier forms better than anybody. So the question is, as one gathers the audience, does one gather the audience towards engagement or subjugation? Do you gather people towards their conversation and disagreement into a reflection, or are you merely manipulating people? I mean, who is it? I think John Law in last season used the phrase that all advertising is a form of terrorism.
Yeah,
and I thought, wow. and it is true. But the question is then, for does the building of a community have to take the same form as transforming thought or engaging imagination or engaging a sense of humor? I mean, you can gather people with a smile and an invitation that is feels respectful, feels, I know that you're an individual and I don't want to take that away from you, but join us on this. We need people who can think for themselves. And this type of gathering an audience means that we might find that audience engaged and enjoined with us. Can that tool be used out by manipulating people's fear, like it is in the United States right now, where you see a small group of people who've been powerfully gathered by their fear and their sense of inadequacy? But that's not unlike we've seen it in history before. We've seen the same tools being used before, not just historically, but in other countries right now. Mm-hmm. So that when people are gathered by a common emotional thread, it's sometimes very dangerous. It is often very dangerous. I can't even think of a way that it wouldn't be dangerous, even if it's for a positive outcome, because that can be flipped. But if people are gathered with a sense of humanity and a sense of values, so intention and values, they need to be connected. If we try to say, well, let's not work that way, because if we engage people, if we build a momentum towards a project, it will always be manipulative. I don't think so. I think it's more possible that people just won't connect to it because that's not the way they're connecting anymore. I'm trying to think what the statistics are about how many pings and notifications that people get in the course of a day. They're drowning in data. they're producing a flood of data. The only way to sort of show up in as a frequency is to show up intermittently and regularly. So one can't just hope for that one announcement to have an impact. And it is true, Seth Godin was actually at Purchase the other day. He was talking about you only need the size audience that you need, and you don't need a larger audience than that, but you need that audience to be committed to you. And in fact, to find that audience, you still have to interrupt the noise of other people's projects and other people's ideas. And you can't interrupt that noise by using old forms of finding people. You have to find unique ways to find people. And one of the unique ways you need to find people is to show up. And even if you don't catch the beginning of the prompt, you catch some part of it. Mm-hmm. And once you catch some part of it, your attention begins to be caught and your commitment begins to be gathered and your curiosity gets piqued and you yourself begin to draw other people towards the thing that was interesting to you. And that could come in the form of a hoax, that could come in the form of a joke, that can come in the form of a game, that can come in the form of a piece of beautiful poetry that shows up. Where did that come from? What is that connected to?
I have one thing that I wanted to mention. I thought about gathering audience. That could be, again, just an intro to forming a community.
Yeah.
I could imagine that just you pick us up from these people far and apart. We come together at and experience something together. And from that moment, the
relationships are being built.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, the main project in traditional audience gathering, you do all of these things and then you have your event where the income is generated and then it's over. Mm-hmm. And that's it. Whereas this way of thinking is you actually build towards a medium-sized project or a big project, and then you follow it with small projects and then maybe another big project. So it becomes a continuity of shared interest that may go on forever, like certain religions go on forever, right? But it also might transform and become other things, or it might just have an end date where it's brought to a conclusion with a finale and a ceremony that ends the entire experience before other ones mm-hmm. begin. Mm-hmm. I think that's just a different way. If you think of any projects that we make as having the audience not brought in, but we've designed it for that interaction, now we have to shape not only what we're doing with it, but what they're doing with us. And now it evolves, and now it begins. I've done a lot of immersive theater, and there comes a point where you have to rehearse with some kind of audience, because you actually don't know the piece that you're doing until you do. And the more you anticipate from audience interaction, from interaction that's simple to interaction that may be complicated, to branched narratives where you need to think through all the different possibilities and then be flexible and excited about the ones you haven't thought about. All of those types of designs require the rehearsal process, the creation process, to include the other. I know the Punch Drunk company in the UK are very committed to building an understanding of what the audience does. When they first begin a project, it's sometimes the audience doesn't go, or they all clump in one place. They don't find different places to move. You know, it takes study to figure that out. Well, in a larger way, when you're building a project across time, you also need to continually study and annotate what you're doing and find better ways to do it. Because, I mean, essentially the old marketing does not exist. It exists like a ghost of the past still walking around, you know, from another era. You know, you see people sometimes who walk around wearing the best thing they ever wore in the 1980s, and they're still wearing it. I think there's a lot of marketing that's like that too. It's a lot of audience gathering. It's like, you know, billboards are funny. Everyone spends money on buses and billboards. And I was standing outside of Grand Central Station the other day, and I was looking at all these big billboards for this new movies that were showing up. And I looked at the people walking down the street, and they were all in their phones. So all this money had been spent on these billboards, and none of them saw that.
This is actually quite unbelievable. I think that this is the fact that nobody dares to fairly measure the impact of this old style marketing or advertising. There is this notion that it still works, although it doesn't. Still, gigantic budgets are being spent on like TV advertising. And I'm sure that in the US, a similar situation happens in Poland these days, that people stop watching TV. They watch Netflix or they watch YouTube.
Right.
So you are screaming to an audience that's not even there.
That's right. But you know, it's something worse than that, I think, because even when they begin to try to get where people are, they try to show up on the phone and try to show up in some sort of subway car that's been designed, they're still talking at the audience. They're not really beckoning them. They're not asking them to play. They're not looking for those people who are better than lurkers, who really want to sort of engage. Because if they find those people, they might actually begin to build from those early adopters. But not the way they look at people. They look at people as targets, not sources. And when you think of the audience as part source, not just target, it's a paradigm shift. Because it's the paradigm shift of really beginning to think about intention, think about building community. You have to go back to thinking about like the idea that you're, the ideas and the projects that you're generating. What's the value of them? What's the need of them? What's the potential for them? And it doesn't mean that you have to give people what they want, but it means that you have to be take a leadership position in thinking about what is it that I think people could use or could need or are hungry for, even though they may not know they're hungry for it.
One other thing that strikes me all the time when I look at the old school marketing or advertising is that it's always top down. It's one directional. It's never two ways. It's never bottom up. And I think that this early engagement that you are talking about would come from just changing the paradigm, shifting the paradigm there.
That's right. That's right. I mean, part of it is the way these companies are organized. I mean, they're organized hierarchically moving up. And here they need a paradigm which is actually spreading out. And I understand why it's so hard for them, because it's very hard to engage with a shifting paradigm when you internally to your organization or your corporation have a completely different paradigm. And yet we hear the noise of they know that this is the issue. So they take the word transmedia. In a way, when I hear people in the corporate world, corporate entertainment especially, use the term transmedia, they talk about being everywhere on all platforms. And this is not the same thing. This is about designing a journey for an audience that is own creative experience, its own unfolding, which is very different than just like, we're everywhere. We've got to this, and we are here, and we're, I mean, very often when people say they're on Instagram or they're on Twitter, all they are doing is the same announcement is there. And if you saw it once, you don't need to see it twice. In fact, you don't need to see an announcement. You need something that is actually a little piece of content and then get pulled to another piece of content, at which point you have actually begun to be the main actor or character in the story. You're already in it,
mm-hmm.
and before you know it. Whereas they're actually treating the audience with a sort of sense of fear. Like, you ought to be in this. You ought to see this. You're going to miss out. These are the messages of most marketing. Rather than, please join us. Or, have you ever seen anything like this? What would you do with this problem? Help us fix this. Help us transform this. Challenges. I mean, treating the audience with some kind of enthusiasm. as opposed to sort of they're a necessary thing in order for us to make our next projects, you know, making our projects successful. Butts in the seats. There was a director I heard once, somebody, it was a post-play discussion, and they said, well, what do you want the audience to leave with? And the director said, I just want them to leave with their coats. And I thought, you know, before they said that, you could see for the production, and you knew that's really all they really cared about. They were just happy that they had bought their ticket, and they're now happy for them to leave. And that's not going to succeed. And that's not what we need. We need directors and producing directors, creative directors who have some kind of love, some kind of affection, some sort of desire for transformation in the community at large and the audience at first.
I have this thought which says, like, but it requires a different mindset.
Yeah, completely.
And changing mindset from old ways to new ways is probably the most difficult boundary to cross.
Do you know what you're saying is true, but we have a different tool set most people don't use. But to use that tool set effectively, you actually need to refocus your heart in a different way to engage that mind in a powerful way. But the tools are sort of there. I mean, what you were saying earlier is like these are potentially dangerous tools. They are potentially dangerous tools if one has no heart for the audience, if one has no desire to continue to build democratic civilization, non-secular society. If one doesn't continue to sort of want to evolve towards progress, one can actually use this tool set in a very destructive way. So the tool set is neutral. You know, a theater is a neutral platform. What you put on it is what matters. And all of these interlaced platforms in a transmedia game, live event, they're neutral. The new availability of interlocking platforms taking place not at one moment, but over time and using multiplicity of appearance, they don't have a meaning, but they have the potential to provide a way to get an audience engaged.
We unpacked transmedia, we unpacked a lot of things regarding immersive theater, but we didn't unpack the gameplay yet. So let's do that.
I had originally created one course, Transmedia and Performance, and it then became Transmedia and Media Entangled Performance. It then shifted to Media and Immersive Performance, and then it became a second class in Immersion and another class in Gameplay and Performance, because the deeper we got into looking for what ways does the audience create emotion? How does emotion and how does ideas and collective power of the group get engaged? Game has most of those tools. And so dramatic narrative is always stealing from game. And game is always trying to steal back from dramatic structure, but it doesn't usually know how to do it very well. So I feel like, what if we really looked at the question of that ties them both together? And so it ties dramatic narrative and gameplay and game dynamics is world building. So both of them need worlds, whereas in play or in a novel, in a film, you might just have a dramatic structure built along a plot. But for the game, the plot becomes a hindrance because the player is at the center of it. But the story, if you take the story of a Hamlet, take Hamlet for a minute. Okay, why not? Always grab Hamlet. So Hamlet has the central characters. It has the peripheral characters. It has the unseen characters. It has the characters that existed before the play happened who have now died, like the ghosts. You have the characters that follow and the reign of Fortinbras after Hamlet's gone. So the story world rolls out in time, far back to far forward. We can speculate. It's already implied, but we can also speculate and create the timeline of people. We also have the countries of Denmark, we have the countries of Norway, we have the countries of England described. We also have Renaissance England, where the play was born. We also have the different performances that have happened of the play and the different interpretations. And now you have what's in the pocket of Claudius. Nobody talks about what's in the pocket of Claudius, but potentially there is a pocket and he might have something that we never see. That's the story world. It extends far beyond what any play can show you or what any film can show you, but all of you need that story world in order to understand the story, even though it's not part of the 2 or 3 hours of the play. But in a game, all of that unseen material in the story world, you need it. You might need it because you might have a player who journeys off into a part of the narrative that wasn't originally in Shakespeare's. You might use time, you might use different dimensions, depending on the design of the game and the different layers and levels for the player to engage in. Now the story world is kind of important. So this issue of what's the story and what's the story world is a factor when you're looking at like what's the connection between dramatic structure and game. What's shared is the issue of the story world. They both need the story world. One of them draws from it in one way in a dramatic structure, and in game, it needs to be much more open-ended to the mechanics and the challenges that the audience is engaged in. So in that center place between the two, in the story world, you need world building. You need to think about society. You need to think about culture. You need to think about food. You need to think about all kinds of questions of behavior. And now, in order to get the audience interested, you could take some of this material and export it to what the audience first gets to see in a series of packages, in a series of gifts, in a series of projection designs. So you've got the story world. Now it's available for you in transmedia, and it's available for you to market the show. It's available for you to follow up with the audience to create their own material out of the story world. So always it is trying to figure out what draws our attention in and what keeps our attention activated. Games give a lot of tools for audiences to actively find, choose different abilities that we ask of them. It pulls the audience member out of the passive relationship into interactive, like escape rooms and puzzles and those kind of games, but potentially also, and I think in the finer games where the audience actually has more agency and more co-creative ability, now they are deeply involved in choices and can do things in the story world of the game that actually might make them realize that they have some complicity with Prince Hamlet. They might have some connection to Claudius. A friend of mine performed Claudius in the Inside Hamlet LARP that goes on at Elsinore. And he's talking to me about like the experience of Hamlet being inside of the LARP of Hamlet is completely more profound and life-changing than seeing the play. Although seeing the play can be wonderful, you know, reading it, acting it, all of these things are tremendous experiences. So games are a critical facility and ability that human beings have for interaction and for transformation. So why would a theater person not be interested in games?
Do you see LARPs, like large action role playing, to explain what the abbreviation means, as a game?
Yes, it's a little bit free form. It's also a little bit like theater in that the people who engage in live action role play or LARPs have to be knowledgeable about the story world. That makes a better experience. So some may not do it, but if they do it, it's much more rewarding, immersive, and compelling emotional experience. There are actors who know the story world less than LARP players know the story world of their pieces. The skills and craft of acting and the skills and craft of LARP role play are on a spectrum of intensity. And the shape of the narrative and what it ends up sharing, there's an overlap, and the overlap is very interesting. The degree of information one brings to the actors and designers for a production is essentially the story world, which is the same material that the LARP designer needs. It's the same material that the game designer needs. And it's ultimately the bathtub that the audience gets to take a bath in. And the level of immersion, to use the bathtub as an example, is it's either a very shallow bath or it's a very deep bath that comes up and you can slide straight into it.
I just realized that in this episode, we are not so much crossing the borders, we are actually making them disappear. So we now just describe the LARP as like a deep end of the immersion. And it just occurred to me that Aga, you and me, we do something on the other end of the spectrum of the depth of the engagement. Think about the exercises or little simulations that you do as a designer. Or when I do, when I'm trying to get people, you know, to feel, how does it feel to work with a different mindset? So the challenge is there to make it as small and as cheap as possible using like the office supplies, for example. And we make a tiny little story world and say, okay, this is the world. These are your boundaries. These are the rules. Now build something. Mm-hmm. And it's actually very cheaply, deeply transformational sometimes.
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a new connection for me.
We have an exercise in the theater called the mirror game, where two people mirror each other's behavior. At the point at which they are both completely present to each other, nobody knows who's beginning and nobody knows who's following. They live in a simultaneity of experience. And when the creator of a project has created something that the audience has now met with their attention and their enthusiasm and their imagination, at that point, the creator and the audience or player, that boundary disappears. And now they're in a process with each other that someone will need to end. As we've seen with sometimes there are films where the people end it and the audience goes, no, 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 this is not over. We want a sequel. And they're, no, no, it's over. Oh, no, it's not. We'll say when it's over. I mean, I've done plays where, to my great affection and love, audiences did not want to leave the theater and they wanted to talk and they wouldn't just leave and they would talk. And they would talk. And you suddenly realize, isn't this what we wanted? Isn't this really what ultimately what we wanted is to get to meet these people, to have this conversation, and then learn about their experiences and their
reflections? Like, yeah.
And now, you know, sometimes you have enough of those experiences, whether you do them as a creator or you do them as an audience member, where you just begin to feel not how wonderful is the theater or how wonderful is transmedia or how wonderful is this game, you know, how amazing these people are, amazing it is to be alive at this moment with this possibility, how many things I could do that I'm not doing. That's what it's about. And that's gets back to intention. If you have sincere and loving intention for people's attention, and you develop it creatively with democracy and imagination yourself, there are beautiful projects to be made. There are beautiful boundaries to be blurred.
Is there a book that you could recommend to our audience?
It's a book called Building Imaginary Worlds by Mark Wolfe. Although it's largely focused on science fiction and games, I think it's just marvelous tools and thoughtfulness about the building of work in alternate reality.
Ah, I'm going to order it off Amazon like immediately. So speaking of alternative realities, if you weren't who you are, who would you be?
Who would I be? It's interesting. Well, I have to, this might be a strange answer, but at the College of Extraordinary Experiences, I was in what my students call a triple. I was sharing a room with two other fellas, And I loved both of them so much. One was John Law, who your listeners will know and can imagine what it's like to share the same space of dreams with John Law. The other person is Charles Michel, who lives much of his life as a nomad. And there's something about the freedom that John Law evokes in his thoughts about life. And there's something about the nomadic life of Charles Michel that I think what I would be is a nomad, a traveler. Yeah, I ran away from home when I was 15 and I didn't come back until I was nearly 18. And I traveled all over Europe and North Africa. And even though it was a long time ago, it left its mark in a desire for travel nomadically. As Paul Bowles says, not a tourist, but a traveler, because a traveler doesn't know where they're going. I think I would be that person. I might not like it, but if I have an alternate reality that I would embrace, it would be that David.
David, thank you very much for this conversation. Right. Amazing as usual.
Thank you.
And I hope to be continued.
Yes, I hope so too. Lovely.
Thank you, David.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Catching the Next Wave podcast. We would love to hear from you on Twitter at Malka6 and at DLS6. You can find more details on www.catchingthenextwavepodcast.com.